Thank you for tuning into this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you'd like to learn more about this podcast, visit lastborninthewilderness.com. Links in the description below. If you'd like to drop Patrick a line, there are two ways to do that. For those in the United States, you can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a voicemail of up to 3 minutes in length. Second, you can drop an audio file by following the instructions through the link in the description of this episode. Thanks for listening.
In this episode, I speak with Brian Muir. Brian is a co-editor at BrazilWire.com. He is a correspondent for Telesur English for the program From the South. He's the co-editor of the book Year of Lead, Washington, Wall Street, and the New Imperialism in Brazil. Brian has been living in Brazil for over 20 years, and I first became aware of Brian from his appearances on the really excellent radio program podcast, This Is Hell, hosted by Chuck Mertz. I'd recommend anybody listening to this, if you haven't listened to This Is Hell yet, This Is Hell is a great program, and Brian has been on that program quite a few times. And so after listening to his most recent interview on there, I'm like, you know, I really do need to talk with Brian about these fires in the Amazon in Brazil. I'm sure that most of you are aware. Of course, if you're listening, you're probably somewhat aware of this event. A huge plume of smoke, or several plumes of smoke, had drifted 1,000 miles over the city of Sao Paulo, where Brian was at the time this happened. So this was on August 19th. He talks about it in his recent piece, for Brazil Wire called The Day the Sky Went Out. He talks about his experiences of being in Sao Paulo. It was midday. It was still dark out. And he's like, what the hell is going on? It's something's off. There isn't a rainstorm coming. The sunset isn't coming yet. And it was just completely blacked out. A city of 20-something million people, 1,000 miles away, or give or take, from these fires, was blacked out by the smoke coming off of these human-caused fires in the Amazon. Naturally, this led Brian to explore the roots of this. Of course, he's reported on these types of subjects before. And what I mean by that is he's covered a lot of different things involving, of course, Brazilian politics, you know, since Bolsonaro, this sort of neo-fascist or far-right leader that became president of Brazil this year, you know, environmental regulations have been gutted in Brazil. He has given the signal, essentially, to numerous business parties that, yeah, regulation is off the table now, do what you do best. And by that, what I'm referring to is the cattle ranchers and the soy farmers, the loggers, the miners, the oil companies, all these different parties and groups that have a vested interest in maintaining the global economic system and to continue to contribute to its growth. Brazil provides an enormous amount of beef, cheap beef, for the world, particularly the global north, United States and Europe. You have these massive agricultural products involving international corporations. And what they're doing is they're expanding their agricultural production, their pastures, their ranches into virgin rainforest. Now, as Brian explains, you know, this isn't new. This has been going on for 500 years, basically, since colonization began. But we've really seen a spike, particularly with these fires, since Bolsonaro got into power. We haven't had this massive level of deforestation, I think is what Brian says here, since the dictatorship in Brazil, which ended several decades ago. I ask Brian to explain the political situation. You know, how did Bolsonaro get into power? How did this fascist leader get into power when previously Brazil had what would be defined as more center-left governments? Now, what Brian gets into is there were these leaks that came out several months ago from The Intercept showing that the investigation was actually being coordinated very closely by the United States, and that this whole corruption scandal that we witnessed Brazil experience over the past several years, leading to the rise of this far-right presidency, this corruption investigation was basically a coup enacted by the United States government. And so I asked Brian to explain this sort of new, if you can call it new, but it's a new tactic that the United States has used to instigate a political coup in Brazil. And so we can learn from this and understand how the United States has always tried to back really repressive, oppressive leaders in South and Central America, and they use whatever tactics they can in order to ensure that business interests are protected, in order to maintain, again, the sort of global capitalist order. Whenever you have a leftist government come into power in Latin America, The United States pays very close attention to that and works on ways to, through overt or covert ways, undermine those governments and put in new leaders that are more sympathetic to U.S. interests. So we saw this in Brazil, and these leaks that came out just this year from The Intercept show this process and show exactly how that went down. We're now kind of in the wake of this revelation. So Brazil has been in, man, the scandals is just stacking up. And then you put this whole deforestation trend on there, and you're looking at a situation where, as Brian points to in that article I mentioned, if the Amazon rainforest loses another 20% of its volume, which could happen in less than 10 years, if this is, I'm quoting him in this article, in less than 10 years, if Bolsonaro's rate of destruction holds up, a phenomenon called dieback could occur, in which the entire rainforest could dry off and burn down on its own. Like, that's the stakes here. This is just, it's horrifying to see what's happening in the Amazon, and particularly what's happening to the indigenous peoples in these places. One thing we also discussed is how these indigenous communities that have reservations in the rainforests of the Amazon are being invaded by these ranchers and soy farmers. They're coming in and just setting fire to the forest in the reservations. And there's, you know, it's a little difficult to know exactly what happened, but it's really not that hard to imagine what actually has been going on, which is indigenous people have been murdered, have been pushed off their land. And it's just, it's absolutely horrifying what's happening in Brazil right now. So pay attention to this episode with Brian. He does such a great job of explaining this situation. Brazil, to me, like, is a beast of a thing to try to understand. There's so much going on in Brazil. It's a massive country. So I think Brian did such an excellent job of explaining to me what's going on down there. Having a real clear perspective is extremely important when we are talking about what's happening to our forests. Because deforestation, while it's happening in the Amazon at an accelerating rate, it's happening all over the world. And just because it may not be as dramatic, we may not be seeing these massive fires like we're seeing in the Amazon right now, in order to indicate that massive deforestation that's currently happening in the world right now, where forests are being destroyed at an alarming rate, that's happening globally right now. And global capitalism and the very corrupt political systems that back and support this economic system and the interests of this economic system, they're responsible for this. And we, as consumers, are also partially responsible as well. We need to take some responsibility for this as well. If you want to learn more about Brian, I mentioned, of course, he's a co-editor at BrazilWire.com. If you want to go to that website, I'll provide a link down below to Brazil Wire in the description. Also, you can see his reports on Telesur English. And also, go check out the book, Year of Lead, Washington, Wall Street, and the New Imperialism in Brazil. So please go check out that book. I'll provide a link to that down below. And all the other articles that I mentioned in this episode as well will be down in the description. So check that out. Thank you so much for listening to me up to this point. Here is my interview with Brian Meir. Well, Brian, first of all, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. As I was saying before we started recording, I've been looking for the right reason, I guess you could say, to contact you and have you on the podcast. And, you know, just seeing your coverage, your reporting on the wildfires, or they're not wildfires, I guess, they're forest fires purposely caused in the Amazon forest in Brazil. That seeing as much smoke that was coming in, and it, you know, it made Sao Paulo, it went blacked out as a result of that much smoke going over the city. You wrote this really excellent article on that for Brazil Wire. And so, you know, reading and watching as well on Telesur English, you explaining what's going on, who's responsible for these fires, what the implications are. You've done really consistent work on that. And so I thought this was a great opportunity to have you on and to explain what's going on. I have to say, like, trying to catch up on Brazilian politics is always challenging. It's just a huge beast of a thing. There's so much to take in. And you definitely make that easier, I think, for English-speaking people in the United States or wherever they're at. So I just wanted to ask, you know, about your experiences. I know this is several weeks ago, but you were in Sao Paulo when the smoke was over the city, blacking out the city all day. If you could talk about that experience a little bit and what what your path has been down exploring the subject has been since then.
Okay, well, I was picking up someone at the bus station, and Sao Paulo is this huge city. It's like, you know, 30 or 40% bigger than New York or something. So I had to schlep across town to the bus station. I got there early, and I decided to go out and get a cup of coffee in a cheaper coffee place. And it's like 3 p.m. I walked out of the bus station. It was just dark. All the streetlights were on. And I just like, I checked my, first thing was like, I checked my phone. Did I blow the time? Am I late? Could it really be this early? Because it's, you know, it's winter here in the Southern Hemisphere, but it still doesn't get dark till like 5:40 p.m. And I just remember thinking, well, that's weird. And I just went out, you know, having a few beers afterwards, and the vibe was really weird. The air felt really clammy. But none of me and my friends were really paying attention to what was going on until my wife sent me a message, said, well, this got dark because of the forest fires in the Amazon. And my first reaction was to think, well, that can't be true. Maybe it's fires going on in the state of São Paulo, because São Paulo is over 1,000 miles from the closest Amazon. That would be like forest fire smoke from, you know, New Orleans covering Chicago, making Chicago go completely dark. And from Louisiana, I mean, I know there's not big forests in New Orleans, but
yeah.
So, you know, but then my next reaction was like, I just felt like the woman in that Lars von Trier movie, Melancholia, thinking like, oh, the world is ending.
Mm. Yeah.
It was really depressing, you know? And then, I was like, fuck. Okay. So I asked Telesur if they wanted to send me up there to do some reporting, because I produce some news programming for them sometimes. And they decided to do it. They sent me up there with another photographer, Nacho Lemus, who's Telesur Spanish. And we decided to go to Porto Velho, because it's the capital of Rondônia. It's a very emblematic state in the Amazon, because Rondônia is the place where, during the late 70s, the World Bank convinced the Brazilian military junta that it was good for the economy, it was good for the national development plan to rip down the Amazon rainforest. And so they lent $1 billion in today's money, 400 million or something at the time in 1980, for the military to cut open highway through the middle of the jungle, which if you look at aerial maps now, is just surrounded by cattle ranches and soy farms, and to relocate 30,000 families from southern Brazil into the state to start ranching, basically. And then what happened is agribusiness, after they'd helped clear the land, agribusiness moved in and kicked all those people off their land, really. So now it's just these huge plantations and ranches, mostly soy is what's coming up now. And so they cut down so much of the rainforest, this social movement started fighting back. The indigenous people who lived there, the rubber tappers, environmentalists, thousands of people were killed. Eventually, they reached a settlement in which they converted like 25-30% of the state into indigenous reserves and natural parks and like rubber tapper reserves. This is the only place in the state where there's any jungle left anymore, right? And so, and these reserves have been encroached upon over the years, even during the PT governments and whatever. But since the dictatorship ended, that was always illegal. That was always, they had, you know, environmental protection agencies. You could sue people for doing that. It still happened. And in, you know, many cases, you could blame government officials for being lax on this. And but the fact of the matter is that during those years of the Lula and PT years, they reduced deforestation in the Amazon region at like, you know, world record rates. They became the world leader in reducing deforestation, reduced it by something like 70-80%. And they started focusing on green economy measures. And one thing that's so emblematic about Porto Velho is that state next door, Acre, is the state that Chico Mendes was from. And so while the cattle ranchers were taking over the political apparatus in Rondônia state, everything was being ripped down, the rubber tappers and indigenous people fought back in Acre and took control, even though Chico Mendes was assassinated, you know, took control of the state government. So they had like 15 years of PT state governments, Workers' Party state governments, where they developed a world model for like a green, sustainable economy, where even today they're still generating billions of dollars a year from Acre in replenishable forest products like rubber, Brazil nut, acai berry, and things like that. And as of last year, the state still had like 95% virgin rainforest cover. So what Bolsonaro's done right now, the geographers in the university in Porto Velho Rondônia are saying, is he's trying to push for a rondonization of Acre and Amazonas. So since he's given the green light for all of the soy international supply chain, soy producers and cattle ranchers, just go into protected land and start burning it down. And the government has started cutting roads into Amazonas and Acre, the same way they did in Rondônia. The highway between Rio Branco and Manaus and Amazonas had 98% forest cover last year, virgin forest. So now they're paving the dirt road that used to connect these two capitals. And on both sides of the road, they're just cutting massive holes into the forest. They've built soy terminals 100 kilometers upriver from Porto Velho in Amazonas State in the town of Humaitá, where 2 years ago, ranchers lit the Environmental Protection Agency headquarters on fire and were never punished for it. Then they're cutting into the Trans-Amazonian Highway 364 towards the town of Apuí, hundreds of kilometers towards the coast. If you look at the aerial photos of this region, satellite photos on Google Maps right now, it's pretty bad. It's pretty depressing, really,
Yeah.
And so that seems to be, and the fact is that, okay, so the dictatorship ended, civil society took back control of the nation, opened up for democracy, and there's this general consensus among the Brazilian population that it's not good for the economy to rip down the Amazon. In fact, a recent poll shows 84% of Brazilians are against Bolsonaro's plans to cut all of the indigenous reservations in half and open them up for logging and mining and stuff. And so the problem is Bolsonaro still thinks everything that the military dictatorship was perfect. He has 16 former military generals from the dictatorship in his cabinet. That's more military people in his cabinet than there actually were during the last two presidents during the dictatorship. And so his plan seems to be really just restarting the dictatorship's approach towards the Amazon, which is rip it all down and hand it over to the ranchers and soy farmers.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, and I want to ask about the influence that these ranchers and soy farmers have. I mean, like, how did they gain such enormous influence over policy, over regulation and all this? I mean, it just sort of blows me away. I know that obviously within sort of a capitalist system, this tends to happen. This isn't like surprising. We have variations of this all over the world, but it's just, it kind of blows me away. Like you mentioned, like they burned down, it was an agency, right? They burned it down. There was no consequences for that.
Yeah.
Like how does that, no. I mean, was that, I don't know. I'm sorry. It's just really hard to comprehend that level of just, outright corruption. I mean, it's sort of crazy to me, and it's been a long-standing thing. Apparently, this has been going on for decades, as you just sort of laid out there.
Well, it's been going on for 500 years. I mean, Brazil was founded by plantation owners and a slave economy, providing monoculture for northern markets. That's never really changed. I mean, there have been attempts to industrialize parts of the country, but mostly it's still, a lot of its big exports are supplying the United States, Europe, Japan, and China with luxury products like sugar, their monoculture, with beef, with coffee. There have been dozens of boom and bust commodity cycles, and a big proportion of the power base, just as it was in the United States, in the early years, are plantation owners. Like look at the founding fathers.
Yeah, right.
What was Thomas Jefferson? And the thing is, it's important to keep in mind that what's driving all of their power, what gives them their power, are companies like Cargill from the United States, which is the richest corporation in the world. It made $152 billion last year, which is building, soy ports in the middle of the Amazon jungle, soy terminals so they can ship soy overseas. It's mining companies from Canada. It's the U.S. doesn't get much of its beef from Brazil anymore, but it did during the time when all the rainforest was really aggressively being cut down. McDonald's was one of the biggest buyers of beef from Rondônia in the 1980s. So these people, these ranchers, have a lot of political power, and they're overrepresented in Congress, so that they have a caucus in Congress which spans almost all of the political parties. And, you know, Brazil's like 15% of the population is rural, but something like 40 or 50% of the people in Congress are big rural landowners, big ranchers and farmers. So the these are families that have had power for a long time. It's very hard to get rid of, you know. So that's the situation. They're backed by international capitalist interests, so that they're hard for locals to get rid of. And now they're backed, you know, their aggression is now totally backed by the current government. You know, in Rondônia, where fires were up in the six counties around Porto Velho when I was there last week by 290% this year, most of happening on indigenous reservations and things. The governor is from Bolsonaro's political party. He's a former military police colonel, and he's backed by the cattle ranchers. And, you know, Bolsonaro got 72% of the vote in this state. Mm-hmm. So it's, wow. You know, it's not a very good situation right now politically. There's no sign, for example, that the local government's going to do anything to stop the fires. In fact, the fire department in the state of Rondônia, I have a friend who's a journalist there. She called them up to learn about their plan, how they were putting out fires. They called the plan No Fires 17. 17 is the number, the ballot number of Jair Bolsonaro's political party. So they used the fire extinguishing efforts as a way to campaign for him.
Oh my God. Man. Yeah, that's crazy. And I think this may be the same journalist that you mentioned in this article that for Brazil Wire that you wrote, Amazon in Flames on the Ground in Porto Velho. And in that, you quote her saying, we warned everyone that this was going to happen, she said. We said that President Bolsonaro's rhetoric would pull a mental trigger. He gave the order when he relativized the issue of environmental crimes, when he discredited the work of the environmental protection agencies, and when he ridiculed the fines, he gave an order. He said, do it. So what has Bolsonaro's effect been on environmental regulation? How has he allowed for this space for this type of thing to happen?
After the 2016 U.S.-supported coup in Brazil, one of the first things that Michel Temer, the new president, did was cut funding to the environmental protection agencies by 51% across the board. And so this caused a spike in new fires, nothing compared to right now. What Bolsonaro did after taking office is he fired the state environmental protection agency superintendents in 22 states, including Rondônia, in February, and he hasn't replaced any of them yet, so that their bureaucracies are all crippled. They can't do anything without getting authorization from the federal government in Brasilia. The federal environmental ministry is now run by a rancher who's been accused of committing environmental crimes and is also apparently a white supremacist. I was just giving an interview with some Canadian white supremacist on the radio this week. It's just a whack job, you know. So they're crippled. They can't even do anything. They don't have the autonomy to arrest somebody anymore for starting a fire or cutting down trees on an indigenous reservation or in a national park. You know, that's just been like they have to get the okay from Brasilia first, and it's not coming. So the other thing is he cut funding for the agency to fight greenhouse gas emissions and climate change by 95%. And and when the director of the scientific, the Space Research Institute, which is a governmental agency that works with an analysis of satellites, photos, and things like that, when he produced a report that said forest fires were going out of control in the Amazon, Bolsonaro told him he was crazy. He was just spreading fake news because he's connected to environmental NGOs or something. And the guy like fought back against Bolsonaro and he got fired. And now that agency is not releasing any new data. So he's just like buried all of it. He's accused, like, just ridiculously, you know, accused international environmental NGOs like Greenpeace or the World Wildlife Federation of setting the fires so that they could get more funding.
Okay. You know? Yeah.
And so, you know, and then, oh, he said that, he said it's an incursion into Brazil's sovereignty for foreigners to care about what Brazilians do to their property, right? Which is, it's an argument. Sovereignty is a very important argument in the third world that, you know, countries should have their own self-determination without interference from Europe and the U.S. Except that in his case, he's just opened up the Alcantara rocket launching base in Maranhão on the edge of the Amazon to the U.S. military. It's the first time U.S. military are coming on Brazilian soil since World War II. He's going into joint military operations with Southcom. And since the coup, they've sold 75% of the petroleum reserves at below market rates up to the U.S. and Europe and a little bit to China, too. So he's not actually doing anything policy-wise that would suggest that he cares about sovereignty. In fact, he's kind of transforming Brazil into this U.S. puppet state, as it was in the 90s in a lot of ways, you know? So, you know, I mean, that's basically what's, to keep things simple, I mean, Brazil, like I said, it's hard to try to explain.
Yeah.
It's a big, complex country.
Yeah, it's complicated. And I think it was in the interview, maybe you did with This Is Hell, but I remember hearing you say somewhere, I mean, we talk about the United States' influence in Latin America. You know, many Latin American countries are, you know, geographically quite small, relatively speaking, especially to Brazil. Brazil's this massive space. Yeah. So it's like, you think of how much of, how many resources are in Brazil, and you can only imagine that the United States is very interested in having some sort of control over that or some influence over the politics of the region. And so I wanted to ask about that, because that is something that, you know, I would have to sit and research in more depth. But I know The Intercept in Brazil released some leaks showing some of the corruption that's been going on over the past several years, how the United States has been involved in getting rid of Lula and all of that. Like, that whole process has been using law and, you know, supposedly trying to deal with corruption, has actually been used as a way to depose certain leaders that don't meet U.S. interests and then put in leaders that do actually meet U.S. interests in the region. If you could talk a bit about that, I mean, I think that that needs to be understood, like how Bolsonaro got into power and how we're now seeing this really kind of an apocalyptic sort of scenario with the Amazon rainforest right now, and understanding that this didn't come out of nowhere. This isn't something that necessarily hasn't happened before, but we need to understand, you know, how the United States has sort of influenced this. I think it's important to note that when Bolsonaro was elected, it was very shortly after he was elected, he came to the United States for a visit, and I think the first place he visited was the CIA headquarters. I mean, that just, to me, like, whether you understand what's actually going on or not, that should just be a pretty strong indication that there's something going on here. A relationship there that isn't necessarily publicized or talked openly, but, you know, it's there. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in that question. I understand that. But if you could give, you know, me and everyone else listening some context as to how someone like Bolsonaro could get elected in Brazil.
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of U.S. interaction in Latin America, it's completely understandable how someone like Bolsonaro could get into power, because the U.S. has repeatedly, over and over again, thrown out leaders that don't follow their economic interests. You know, there was an article maybe published 10 years ago in Harvard Latin American Quarterly or Magazine or whatever, it's from Harvard University, which said that in a 100-year period, like 1894 to 1994, the U.S. engaged in 44 successful coup d'etats in Latin America. You know, not even counting the actual military occupations. At one point, the U.S. under Woodrow Wilson invaded Mexico so many times during the Mexican Civil War that both sides officially asked Wilson to pull out, saying that he wasn't helping either of them.
Wow.
You know? And so, I mean, moving forwards in time, we see that, you know, the 1964 coup in Brazil was supported by the U.S. government. That's documented. You know, that's publicly available information now. And we see a series of coups and coup attempts that have happened, orchestrated by the United States, as an attempt to kind of roll back this pink tide of center-left and left governments in Latin America that basically started with Chavez's election in Venezuela. And at one point in the 2000s, most of the governments in Latin America were left or center-left. I mean, we had Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras for the first time ever, you know, in a really long time, had a left government take over. And in the case of Honduras, Hillary Clinton confessed to supporting this coup in the hardcover version of her autobiography and then had it removed for the softcover version. I mean, you know, she said that we had to make sure that Zelaya didn't get back into power. We had to do everything we could. And so there, I mean, Edward Snowden's leaks revealed massive NSA spying on the Brazilian Petroleum Company, which started, you know, surprisingly shortly after Brazil discovered the world's largest offshore deep water oil reserves that would propel Brazil up into being one of the world's largest oil producers in the world. So if you look at all of the world's largest oil producers, how many of them is the U.S. not, you know, trying to overthrow or has overthrown or invaded right now? It's almost all of them, I mean, including. So in 2002, Otto Reich, who's this, you know, cold warrior, neocon who was tied up in Iran-Contra, general sleazebag, started talking on C-SPAN and CNN. He was like assistant secretary of state in the Bush administration for Latin America or something. He started talking about how the biggest problem in Latin America is corruption. You know, and so corruption should be the new enemy of the U.S. And we see this narrative building over the years to the point where it's actually included now in the U.S. government's official like security strategy for the region, corruption. And so starting under the Obama administration, this investigation started called Operation Lava Jato, or Car Wash in English. Now, I think it's one of the most like censored by omission stories in the American media that this has been a joint operation with the U.S. Department of Justice the entire time. You know, the U.S. Department of Justice has not just collected over $2.5 billion in fines from Brazilian companies as part of its participation in this investigation. It tried to gift the prosecutors $680 million last February so they could start a privately managed anti-corruption think tank in Curitiba, which was blocked by the, you know, pretty, you know, corrupt Brazilian court system because it was just so blatantly illegal in Brazil to do. You know, this was money that had been collected by the U.S. government in fines from Brazilian companies operating on Brazilian soil that they wanted to give back as a present to their partners in the investigation. And this investigation, you know, the Intercept leaks now show, was fraudulent and politically motivated the entire time, and that they knew they didn't have any evidence implicating Lula in any kind of corruption the entire time. Even 3 hours before he went on, you know, for his final trial, they knew they didn't have anything on him, right? So that's all like public knowledge now. So this is a corrupt investigation, and has been the entire time. And so on August 20th, 13 members of Democratic members of Congress sent a formal request to U.S. Attorney General Barr requesting clarification on a series of questions about the U.S. government's role in arresting Lula, removing him from the elections, which led to the Jair Bolsonaro taking power. You know, and the Attorney General's office has until September 30th to provide the answers to the questions. Some of the questions are like, describe the involvement of the DOJ in the Lava Jato operation. What led the DOJ to work on this particular investigation. You know, describe the full extent of DOJ's engagement with Judge Sergio Moro, including all technical support, information sharing, and support provided by DOJ contractors. A whole list of questions that I'm really excited to see the answers to. Because the entire time, now, it's been a matter of public knowledge that the DOJ is a partner in this investigation, right?
Yeah.
But none of the papers, like, I was accused of being a conspiracy theorist for mentioning this, even though the information is readily available on their own website.
Yeah.
You know, like, of course it's a kind of conspiracy. It's an investigation. All investigations are conspiracies. But if they're saying it themselves, you can't call me, you know, attack my credibility as a journalist or whatever for talking about publicly available information. And that happened to me. And so I feel vindicated by this, and I feel vindicated by the revelations in The Intercept too,
right,
which shows that everything we've been writing about in Brazil Wire for the last 4 years has been correct. You know, but the papers, I spoke with the correspondent from The Guardian personally the night before he released an article which lied about Lula's conviction. You know, it said that Lula was convicted for being involved in an 88 million real corruption scheme in Petrobras Petroleum Company, which was specifically explained in the ruling to not have any relation to his case. You know, so I talked to him the night before that, and I said, well, why don't you mention in The Guardian that the DOJ is a partner in this investigation? He was like, oh, well, our readers wouldn't be interested in that information. But why not? You know,
oh,
you would think,
man,
most of them are in the U.S. Why wouldn't they be interested in that information?
Yeah. Yeah, that's like, what is that called? I mean, that's sort of something that I feel like Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman wrote about in Manufacturing Consent. It's like a way that, you know, supposedly we live in these democracies and we have free press, but there's like these different levels of almost like self-censorship that journalists take on. And we just said there's crazy. That's interesting. But I do, and I wanted to say that, like, you know, you've mentioned that Brazil Wire has been writing about this for years and had been labeled something like a conspiracy theorist. You know, it seems like this has been knowledge that people could seek, and now that there has been a major leak with The Intercept and all this, it's like, yeah, it's a vindication of your work and all of that. It's like when people were talking about the NSA and the surveillance state here in the United States, and then people were like, yeah, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. I don't think it's really that sophisticated or that big or that big of a problem. And then Snowden comes along and all of these documents get released, and they're like, oh, you were correct. It's just like, yeah, it just gets vindicated over and over again.
Accepted. You know, another thing is, like, I wrote, you know, I've been writing for a long time, but I wrote a lot for some of these kind of left-wing or progressive, you know, think tanks for a while, like COHA and CEPR, Center for Economic Policy Research, and other publications I thought were more progressive than they really are, like NACLA. NACLA's shifting a lot. But, you know, when you write for those kinds of publications, you have to be incredibly rigorous with your fact-checking, mm-hmm. you know, especially if you're talking about U.S. involvement and everything. So, like, the average article I've written for Brazil Wire over the last 5 years, it's had like 30 or 40 linked sources in it. It's not just like ranting like Alex Jones or something.
Yeah.
You know? It's like actually like real sources, good sources. So just like, I had somebody who works for CNN accuse me of being a conspiracy theorist for an article that had like 35 linked sources in it about U.S. Department of Justice involvement in Lava Jato, including their own webpage, their own documents.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, well, you have to be very careful making statements like that.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I'm happy that there has been some vindication there. I mean, you know, I think that's good. It just sort of shows how good of a journalist you are in being able to be very rigorous in your fact-checking, but also just sort of, you know, stand up against the heat a little bit and be like, yeah, well, this is what it is. And in time, I will be vindicated. So I'm glad that you have been. And I want to ask this as well, because, you know, this way in which the United States has gotten its involved in Brazilian politics, and in a sense, I mean, that you describe it as a coup that's taken place. And I think when I think of United States involvement in Latin America, there's a few things that really come to mind, which is, you know, direct military intervention, or backing, you know, dictatorships directly through the CIA, or I think of these rather almost, they might be clandestine, but they're kind of aggressive in how, you know, everybody in the country, I sense, knows what's going on. It's pretty obvious when it starts to happen. But in this case, as you're describing here in Brazil, it seems to be that there's, and this is my question really, is this an exception to how the United States has dealt with or enacted coups in Latin America, as far as using corruption and law in order to get to remove leaders that are not sympathetic to U.S. interests? Or like, has this been done before, I guess, or is this more of a new trend in how the United States approaches these things?
Well, it's a new, you know, strategy. This was like a mediatic, legal coup, but it's happening all over the world. And, you know, with heavy use of, social media and, you know, Cambridge Analytics style crowd manipulation tactics that you saw in the color revolutions in the Middle East and stuff like that. So actually what you have right now is eight, you know, current or former Latin American presidents or vice presidents, most of which were from center left or left parties, have been accused of corruption in U.S. backed anti-corruption investigations in the last 15 years, including Michelle Bachelet, whose real, you know, election campaign, her party's campaign, was destroyed by baseless corruption accusations against her that were leaked to the media by U.S. DOJ supported operatives, you know, connected to Operation Car Wash. You have Rafael Correa, who was a great president. You know, they're trying to arrest him for corruption now. Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, they're trying to arrest for corruption. And in all of these four cases, the cases are very, very flimsy. But they're being treated more as like a media character assassination attempt, especially on the social media. You know, so I think what we're talking about is like new kinds of techniques to manipulate governments. I don't know if you saw The Great Hack, you know, the movie The Great Hack.
I haven't seen it yet. I've heard that it's pretty good, though. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a description of what Cambridge Analytica did in Trinidad and Tobago in the election season, you know, in 2011, 2012, where they essentially just started a social movement online to get youth interested in not voting, because they knew the political coalitions were broken into, you know, Indian Trinidadians and Afro-Trinidadians, not the East Indian, you know, and the Afro-Trinidadians would not vote because it was cool not to vote because of this youth campaign they started, but the East Indian Trinidadians would act like they weren't going to vote, but they eventually listened to their parents, so that by doing this, they would throw the election to the, the East Indians who were paying them. And the techniques for crowd manipulation they were using, very similar to what happened in Egypt and things like that, is very similar to 2013 in Brazil. Now, we don't have any information that Cambridge Analytica was involved. We do know that Steve Bannon was involved in the Bolsonaro family's What's Up campaign of character assassination in the last elections against Haddad, where they convinced millions of voters that Haddad, if he was elected, would transform their children into homosexuals, that he was a child molester and things like that.
Wow.
We know they were involved in that, but something very similar, if it wasn't Cambridge Analytica, it was some people using similar tactics. I think the first attempt to overthrow the government, the PT government, was these 2013 kind of like spontaneous color revolution style protests, which I participated in at the time, thinking they were a good thing initially, but then saw how quickly they became manipulated. You know, so I don't know. To answer your question, I think it's a new form of, well, okay, I'll be even more specific, right? Like, if you look at the way intelligence agencies operate, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I had an uncle, actually, who went into military intelligence during the Vietnam War. He was a Democrat, and you know, he got very disillusioned, but they never let him retire. You know, he ended up like getting drunk with Lech Walesa in Poland in the early 90s or whatever. But he told me, you know, the way they do this is they have like an ordered list of desirability of possible outcomes when they want a certain result in a different country. And the most desirable thing is that the citizens of that country elect the candidate that the U.S. wants to win there. You know, that's the best bet. And then so they, if that doesn't look like it's working out, it's like, okay, well, let's fund the opposition party. If that doesn't work out, they go down one level, you know? The least desirable, you know, strategy that they ever want to use is invading another country. And so fostering some kind of like, you know, I think the first strategy, and I think one of them, you also have to look at like who benefits. You know, why would, if you're looking at something weird that happened in another country involving a regime change, that shift, a major ideological shift and things like that, well, who benefited from the process? We know that the big American petroleum companies benefited incredibly from throwing Dilma Rousseff out of power. You know, because 75% of the petroleum was privatized, and a lot of it going up to like Chevron, ExxonMobil, and these other companies sold off at below market rates. And then they got $300 billion in tax abatements over the next 20 years for drilling oil in Brazil. So they benefit, and you know, a lot of companies benefit. You know, a lot of U.S. companies benefit. But I think the point is, they were hoping that Ercio Neves would have just won the election in 2014. You know, one big foreign correspondent told my co-editor Dan that there's this unwritten rule among all the foreign correspondents in Brazil that, you know, the U.S. wants Ercio Neves to win these elections. And David Axelrod's former consulting firm came down to run Neves's electronic media campaigns during that election season, or during the pre-election season. It's reported in Folha de São Paulo newspaper. And so we know there was involvement from the U.S. trying to throw the election to Ercio, but he just couldn't pull off. First of all, because he's actually incredibly corrupt. And all of this infantilized anti-corruption campaigning blew back at the party that was initially supposed to be helping. Like, he was caught on tape threatening to kill a witness in a multi-million-dollar bribery scandal he was involved in. You know?
Wow.
Nobody, despite the fact that they were doing their best to target the PT for these corruption allegations the entire time, nobody believed that the PSDB party was not corrupt. You know, so he failed. It was close. He failed to win the election. But then immediately, and I feel like the PSDB party has a historic, I don't feel, I know it has historic strong ties to the Clintonian Democrats. You know, Fernando Henrique Cardoso was really good friends with Bill Clinton. And I think they bet all of their chips on the idea that Hillary Clinton was going to win the elections. And so when that didn't happen, there was chaos and infighting on the right. They managed to throw out Dilma Rousseff with no impeachable offense committed whatsoever. It was a budgetary infraction that she was later exonerated from, that was legalized one day after she was thrown out of office by the Senate, which all governments in Brazil do. It was basically like, we have to hand in our budget report. Let's shift a couple million dollars from this department to that department to cover a hole. You know, that's what she was impeached for. But, you know, the New York Times, the media companies connected to the American integral state, which is, you know, the corporations, the think tanks, the government, the political parties, and everything, they were all acting like Dilma Rousseff was involved in Petrobras petroleum corruption, which is like, that wasn't even on the table. She wasn't even charged with that. But the New York Times mentioned her name in association with Petrobras corruption 8 times during the week before the elections. You know, so, but anyway, so that didn't, you know, that didn't work. That threw chaos into everything, because the fact is, you know, Trump's handlers or whatever, Steve Bannon, those guys love the idea of a neo-fascist taking another country and, in the world, you know, they love the idea of this racist culture war, you know, cultural Marxism enemy type guy. And so I'm not so sure that the U.S. would have backed Bolsonaro if Hillary Clinton had won the election, but I don't think they would have done much to stop him, and they would have favored him over the PT taking back the presidency. They would have favored him over Lula. I'm sure, because Lula was talking about renationalizing the petroleum and things like that, doing a lot of things that the U.S. doesn't like, really, which is essentially what the U.S. doesn't like, is any leader in any other country of the world just not taking all of their orders and, you know, trying to stand up for the self-determination and sovereignty of their own people, which is why so many great leaders in around the world, in the South, great leaders, many of whom were not even that far left to begin with, have been thrown out by the U.S., like Salvador Allende in Chile, who's essentially like a social democrat. If you looked at his agenda, he wasn't that more left than Bernie Sanders or something like that, you know, or like a typical Swedish prime minister.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, live up to all these, like, there's like a checklist. And if you don't meet all of these points on that list, then you're out, you know, because you have to meet these certain interests. And if you don't, then, you know, you're not worth it. So, and I wanted to go back a little bit because, you know, at the very beginning we were discussing specifically the Amazon and these forests, and you did an excellent job. Thank you for going over all of that, because I think that context really helps us understand the environmental crisis that's happening in Brazil when we talk about the Amazon forest and the cattle ranchers and soy farmers and all of that. It helps us understand where that power comes from, how they're able to do this, and how, you know, this has been going on for a long time, but we've really seen an uptick of these sort of really destructive fires in the region and expanding agricultural land and into the forests. And so I think the people that have been most directly affected, obviously being in a city like Sao Paulo, seeing the sky blacked out was probably a pretty like jarring event for many, many people. But I think the people that are the most immediately impacted by these fires and this expansion of agriculture is the indigenous peoples that live in the Amazon or in that region. What has been the status with that? I know you mentioned like that as these ranchers and as these farmers expand into the land, I mean, they're actually going into indigenous people's reservations. And so how does that work legally, or how do they get away with that? I mean, I know that there's obviously, I know Bolsonaro has been very, I mean, I don't even know what the right word is, but I mean, rather hostile towards indigenous rights and indigenous people's sovereignty, from the get-go, from his campaign. That was something he said pretty explicitly.
He campaigned on shutting down all of the indigenous reservations.
Okay, yeah.
And handing the land over to the ranchers and miners.
Right.
And he sent out all kinds of signals to them that he's not going to punish them, gutted all the police and agencies. So right now we have a situation where like 20,000 gold miners have moved into the Yanomami Reservation on the border with Amazonas and Roraima, and a lot of them are dying of diarrhea right now because the rivers are all being poisoned with mercury. When I was in Porto Velho, okay, so here's another thing. The one institution that's really fighting on the side of the indigenous peoples right now in the area is the Catholic Church. And it's these old-time liberation theology bishops and nuns and priests. And they have been being surveilled by the Brazilian intelligence agency, ABIN, since last October, since, you know, shortly after Bolsonaro won the election. They're being spied on like they were during the military dictatorship. And I was talking to one of these guys in Porto Velho who's, you know, in his 70s. He's been working with indigenous people for 40 years. And he said that in the last couple months, two remote tribes that were still living in the traditional way in the middle of the forest on the Caripuna Reservation, which has a group of a consortium of 500 ranchers and loggers and miners, soy plantation types moving into it and stealing land right now, have just disappeared in the last 2 months. Nobody's seen them, and he thinks they've all been killed.
Mm. Oh, man.
So,
yeah, I just...
The situation is shitty, man.
Yeah, it's... I just wanted to sort of point at that before we wrap this up, because that's, I think, a key...
Even on a high note,
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, no, it is bad.
Sometimes I just have to laugh because it's so shitty.
Yeah, that's it. It is. It's pretty. I mean, I don't know, man. It's just a lot to take in, and I mean, is there any like acts of resistance that you've seen, you know, Indigenous peoples take up? I mean, I imagine they're not just laying down, seeing this happen.
Yeah, on the same reservation, a bunch of them shot some ranchers with bows and arrows a couple weeks ago. But the problem is these tribes are small, you know. There's like a couple thousand people on these huge reservations, and they don't have automatic weapons and stuff like that. They're fighting back with bows and arrows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not a very fair fight. But I would like to say a few things I think that people in the North should think about doing if they want to help out, you know, because it's not something I think at this point the Indigenous people are going to be, or the Brazilian people in general, are going to be able to pull off by themselves. And it could be twisted around a bunch of ways if governments start getting involved. But one thing that, I mean, we know that during the 80s, I worked at Greenpeace, right, briefly. And, you know, there, environmentalists started putting a lot of pressure, because of what was going on in Rondônia, on McDonald's for buying all of its beef from that area. And it put so much pressure on McDonald's that McDonald's stopped. And now the United States is only like the sixth largest importer of Brazilian beef, you know? And in 2006, Greenpeace released a big report accusing Cargill Corporation of being one of the main responsible parties for Amazon rainforest devastation. And they spent a lot of money on PR. You know, they repositioned themselves as, because of the attention, because of the people talking about boycotts, they repositioned themselves as these kinds of stewards of the rainforest, and they promised not to buy any more soy from soy plantations on newly, you know, on deforested Amazon land. But they put a loophole into the agreement where they would only not buy it if soy was the only thing grown on those plantations. And so the local plantation owners they're buying from are planting like 1 acre of corn and 10,000 acres of soy, and they get around the loophole. And Cargill is still building new soy terminals in the middle of the Amazon jungle. You know, and like right now in the capital of Rondônia, after Lula was arrested, you know, the ruralists, the ranchers and landowners were very worried about Lula, about the PT party coming back in power, because they thought they'd reestablish the environmental agencies and start policing illegal activities. Shortly after Lula was arrested and pulled out of the race, Cargill announced that it's building a new soy terminal in Porto Velho, which is upping their capacity for exporting soy to the U.S. and Europe, wherever else they export it to, from 3.5 million to 6 million tons a year. All right, and this is on the edge of Highway 319, where they're ripping down southern Amazonas state right now off of. And so they've obviously got it written into their business plan that there's going to be more deforestation. And so I know Archer Daniels Midland is involved, but for American citizens, you know, Americans listening who want to put some pressure to try and stop it, I think it's a really interesting or really opportune time to just call your lawmakers, call Cargill, complain about this, see if you can help build some kind of pressure against them, because they've shown in the past that they have at least addressed criticism on this issue and pressure. And there might be, especially if you start associating them with the fact that Indigenous tribes are being wiped out right now too, that's not good for their public image at all, you know. So I hope, you know, maybe that would be something. I know the European Union is going to put pressure on Brazil by threatening to stop importing beef. They get 43% of their beef from Brazil, and that's something. But I don't see Trump, for example, I don't see the federal government in the U.S. doing anything about this. All I see is Trump coming down to the Amazon with Bolsonaro and having a weenie roast or something on burning trees and laughing.
Oh, man. It's a hell of an image. Yeah. No, and I think it is important to sort of focus on this is a, you know, this is serving a global market. This is serving a capitalist market. And so, you know, it's not like, yeah, the people of Brazil can be as upset and protest as much as they'd like, which is great, obviously. But international markets is where it's at. So here in the United States, as you mentioned, or people in Europe or the European Union, putting pressure on these corporations and on the government of Brazil to stem this is key, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, like 90% of all soy produced in Rondônia state is exported, and over 90% of the beef. This stuff that they're growing down there, it's not going to the Brazilian people, and it's not providing jobs because it's all low labor and intensity of activities. And these people don't pay taxes. They don't even, you know, they steal the land. They don't even pay property taxes. So it's not doing anything positive at all for the Brazilian people, which is why 84% of them just voted, just said in a poll last week that they're against all of this. They're against opening up indigenous reservations to agribusiness. The media, the international media, is trying to pretend that Brazilians don't care about the environment and trying to kind of pin this on Brazilian people to deflect attention away from the corporations that finance their newspapers and media companies, you know? It's important to know the connection and find a weak link and try and attack that so that you can positively affect what's happening, because it's not just Brazilian people who are going to be suffering from this. It's everyone. If the Amazon burns down, which they say, if it reaches this tipping point, which they could say could happen by 2030, and burns down, that's not good.
Yeah, that was a point I wanted to say here. Like, the stakes are very high here, because as you wrote in your piece for Brazil Wire, the day this guy went out, you state here, says, if the Amazon forest loses another 20% of its volume, which could happen in less than 10 years if Bolsonaro's rate of destruction holds up, a phenomenon called dieback could occur, in which the entire rainforest could dry off and burn down on its own. So this is like a tipping point, right? We hear about this with climate change and all of this, where you reach certain points where it just, the momentum builds itself and it just keeps on going and creates a feedback loop. Yeah. And the Amazon is a key part of the global climate system. And seeing it go away would be just, I mean, there's no going back from there. So this is...
And also, there's so much natural resource. Like, there's so many medicines that haven't even been discovered. There's so many plants there that haven't even been studied yet.
Right.
It's the most diverse, biological biome in the world. And people will lose in so many ways if we lose all of that. And the cultural traditions there from the indigenous peoples and...
Yeah,
the animal life, and not just, it's not just like global warming and oxygen, it's everything.
Yeah. Well, and just one last note. I mean, I know we have to get going soon, but I just want to say, like, just something that came to my mind is just how insane this system is, just to point to this, because you're literally converting some of the most biodiverse, forests in the world, and you're literally just converting it to monocrop agriculture. Like, think of, like, the most decomplexified way you could, turn something like a forest into that. It's just, it just shows the kind of nature of the system we're in, where that's what's happening, It's hard to get my head around, man, but seems to be what's happening right now, so...
Well, what it really is, it's kind of like a libertarian paradise. There's no more environmental regulations, so the invisible hand of the market is allowed to operate in a natural form, and that's what it does.
Mm-hmm.
So libertarians must be overjoyed with this. just the market's functioning property.
Yeah.
Properly.
Oh man, that's so true. Oh God. Well, Brian, I think you did such a great job explaining all that for me and for the listeners. Thank you. It really clarified a lot of things for me. I'm really happy that we could find a time to do this. As I said, I've been following your work for some time, so it was really good to finally talk with you. And I just want to turn people onto your work here. I know that you're co-editor at BrazilWire.com. And you write there, and also you do, you report for Telesur English, and I think you do that in Portuguese as well, right? In Spanish?
No, just English.
Just English, okay.
No, my Spanish isn't, yeah.
Okay.
They don't have Telesur Portugal. Brazil never came on to the Telesur project it should have.
Okay.
Telesur was originally like Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela when it started. It was supposed to be a socialist CNN.
Oh, okay.
But Brazil never Brazil ever went in on it.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, you're with the English, Telstar English from the South. I've seen your reports with that, and you do an excellent job with that. Also, your book, Year of Lead, Washington, Wall Street, and the New Imperialism in Brazil, which, from what I understand, goes into much more depth about the subjects we discussed regarding the corruption scandals and all of that. So I would ask, I'll put links to all that down and all the articles that I mentioned as well. I'll put all those down in the description of this episode so people can read your work and learn more about this. And, you know, Brian, I don't know if you had any last things you wanted to turn people on to, if you had anything I missed in that, but,
I actually have an article coming out in FAIR today or tomorrow about media, false media narratives about the Amazon fires.
Okay.
If you're interested,
yeah, I'll be sure to read that, and I'll put that in the description as well. People can get those resources there. Brian, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me. It was nice talking to you.
Hey there, thanks for listening. If you'd like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. And you can treat that a bit like a tip jar. And if you'd really like to sustain this work, consider supporting the project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastbornin the wilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release, and also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. As a great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."